Welcome to Bodcast, the Business of Dentistry podcast, brought to you by Practice Plan. Bodcast delivers the best business advice, real-life stories, and practical hints and tips to make your practice a more profitable and sustainable business. And now, here's your host.
Hello, my name's Nigel Jones and I'm Sales and Marketing Director at Practice Plan, and welcome to this latest edition of Bodcast, where we're joined by Jasmine Lobo, who is going to talk to us. We're going to have a conversation around the perceptions of people that are just entering the profession as to what their career path looks like, what the future in general looks like. So welcome, Jasmine. I wonder if you could just introduce yourself for us.
Hello, Nigel. I'm Jasmine Lobo and I am a Dental Foundation trainee. I have recently graduated from Leeds University and I'm currently working at a practice in Swansea. Okay.
So straight away, how are you finding that move into a practice in Swansea?
So at first it was quite daunting, but that's just like with any new job, but I'm actually really enjoying it. It's very challenging, of course, but that's the nature of the profession. But yeah, overall I'm enjoying it, and it's good to, so now I'm on my own. I do have somebody to help me at times, but it's nice to be able to take ownership of my patients and just treat my patients, really.
So is it so far what you thought it was going to be? Because when you're studying, I guess you have a view of what life in general practice is like, and now you're there, is it?
So I think just with every person coming into the profession, and when you're suddenly on your own, the biggest shock is actually the responsibility. You're trained up to, you know, to be able to cope with the responsibility of making clinical decisions every day. That's part of the course at university. But now you're very much making those decisions on your own, and you can ask for help if you want to. But you know, at times there's very difficult decisions to make, and it's taking ownership of those decisions that I find the hardest thing coming into the profession. I thought it would be relatively easy, we're kind of building on my time management skills within the NHS, but that's actually been quite challenging as well.
Oh,
yeah, so, I think, you know, it's a challenge, and hopefully I'll see that challenge through.
So is it a challenge because of just your potential for running late, or is that because conversations with the patients are longer, or there's more clinical challenge than you thought?
So I think there's more clinical challenge than I thought. So definitely. So there's lots of, you see, anything can come through the door, but you only get a set amount of time for each patient. Some patients it can be very very easy decisions to make. You know, it can just be a straightforward examination, nothing wrong with them. And then some patients present with more things than others. And for those patients, you know, you need a little bit more time. I think it's thinking very quickly, and that's something that you develop throughout the year, I suppose. That's one of the purposes of foundation training. And I'm hoping that, you know, well, of course, by the end of the year, I'll be able to think quickly on my feet. But at the moment, I think that's one of the challenges that I'm trying to overcome, just trying to really stick to the time that I'm given.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you said very first off about you're enjoying having your patients.
Yes.
So I suppose that's quite a different sensation, is it? That actually you're taking ownership of these people that are in front of you, as opposed to...
Yeah, so at university, you have a supervisor there to, you know, check every single stage of the work you're doing, and that the decisions you're making are correct. Whereas now, once you've qualified, you kind of have to know whether they are correct or not, and you can't really go asking your supervisor every 5 minutes. You have to be able to make those most decisions yourself, and then there's always the handful of decisions that you're not equipped to handle, and that's the moment where you ask your supervisor.
Yeah, so I suppose you're gaining independence as you're doing all
this.
Yeah,
definitely.
But with a safety net.
That's so at first that that's what I am, quite an independent person, so that's why I found it quite hard. There were sometimes things I didn't know and I'd have to ask them, but actually once you ask a question, you're equipped to the next patient, and you're just learning things all the time and you become more and more independent every day actually.
Okay. And so this first sort of foray into general practice, is that changing the way that you're thinking about your future career, or is it just too early to tell?
So in all honesty, and my trainer is very aware of this, because we had for our training places, we had interviews with our practices. But I'm actually very interested in a surgical career, particularly oral and maxillofacial surgery. So that's in secondary care rather than practice. Just because at university, I didn't particularly enjoy general practice as much as specialised practice, particularly surgery. But actually working at the practice now, I really enjoy it. I'm working in a really lovely place. My team's amazing, which makes the job as well. The patients are lovely, and I get to see such a variety of things. And because I'm building just on so many skills all the time, I enjoy that aspect of it. So I didn't expect that actually. So I'm very happy where I am.
Okay, so that means that you've increased your choices then, in effect, because actually maybe general practice could work for you.
Yes, yeah.
But the specialist point I think is really interesting, because it feels like that's the way of the future, actually. Things have become more and more specialised. What is it about that? Is it just the technical challenge of that, or what is it that you like?
So for oral and maxillofacial surgery, for me, I love working in secondary care. More than primary care. I do love the technical and clinical aspect of it, and the things that you get to do and the things you get to see. So, you know, facial trauma, head and neck cancer, quite local, you can do just local procedures, so taking teeth out in secondary care. Orthognathics, which is moving the jaws about for patients whose teeth don't meet correctly. I did work experience when I was in my fourth year, and I found that I really enjoyed that oral maxillofacial surgery. And then I also did a 2-week placement in my fourth or fifth year of dentistry. I found that it came very naturally to me, actually, a lot of the things, and I was very enthusiastic about it. And you just kind of have a gut feeling that that's what you want to do. I enjoy paediatric dentistry as well.
Right.
I love working with children. I never thought that I'd enjoy that in a million years, because I have no siblings or, you know, nieces, nephews. But actually, treating children comes really naturally to me as well. Mm. So that's a specialty I've considered too.
So it's interesting, because actually you're describing some very positive reasons why you might want to go down that route. I've heard some of your peers, maybe some that are a little bit further out of university, want to go down the same route, but actually because they're wanting to escape general practice or escape the NHS as far as general practice goes. Is that a view that you would say is shared by some of your fellow?
So I do think that's the reason. To be honest, I think that's maybe, you know, possibly a reason that influences me to specialise, because in secondary care, you don't have the money aspect of it kind of there. Every discussion that you have with a patient in general practice is about money. Money's a huge part of it, which is understandable. I mean, you know, if you're paying for treatment, then you want things to work. You want a positive outcome. But with any field of medicine, sometimes the treatments you provide, it doesn't last forever. That's just the nature of dentistry. Sometimes it's not the outcome that you hoped for. You would have warned a patient about that before. But, you know, it's you feel for that patient because you know they've paid that money and you know you warned them it's not going to work out, and you know if things don't work out you still feel it. Whereas in secondary care, I suppose you know you don't have to have that conversation about money. So I suppose in a way, it just takes one of the many stressful factors out of the equation.
See, I think that's a really interesting point. And what you're describing is that, well I'm just wondering, when you're at university, is that a topic that is any time is spent on, like how to communicate with patients, how to manage their expectations in respect of the money side? Or so where does that perception that that's difficult come from before you've even come into general practice?
So, this is a really interesting question, because the whole money side, as much as we're trained in university, it's still so difficult to get used to, actually. So in university, you know, you don't have the discussions about money with patients because the treatment you're providing is free as a student. You have, because you're training as well, and the purpose of university is purely building on your clinical skills, and it's nothing really to do with finances. In a way, you only truly learn the financial side of it when you start foundation training, and kind of the importance of the financial side of it. So in university, of course, you know, as part of a consent taking process, you're taught, yes, you have to mention the cost of each treatment option to a patient, but till you actually, you know, apply that knowledge, you only really begin to understand how important it is that you're mentioning that, and you know, you're literally writing down each cost that you mention in your notes, because sometimes there's so many different options for patients. They have to, and you know, things in Wales, things can range from a simple, you know, £14 all the way up to, you know, like a £190 treatment on the NHS. And then, you know, if you're wanting to go private, then that can extend into the thousands. So
it's interesting there, because I think it's hard sometimes to separate the money discussion from the clinical considerations. Yes. Because depending on how confidently you put across the options can influence which one the patient chooses, and yet your confidence could be affected by a degree of nervousness about the money.
It's always a conversation that you have to have that conversation, and you become more confident in having the conversation. The more you have, the more that you talk about it. You can't avoid the conversation at all. That would just be, you know, that goes against basically the principles of getting informed consent.
Yeah.
But it just adds to the, I don't know, sometimes it might add to a patient's expectations as well. Yeah. You know, if they're paying quite a lot of money and they're always wanting a perfect positive outcome, and
that just adds a bit more pressure.
Yeah, and sometimes that's just, unfortunately, you know, there's only so much you can do sometimes, as much as you try to help.
So I think what's really interesting for me in what you've been saying, Jasmine, is that one of the reasons why you've thought about going down the specialist route for your long-term career, lots of positive reasons, but one of the negative reasons is actually you don't have to have the conversation about money. You don't have to manage patient expectations in quite the same way as you would do in the NHS or private. So it's not that you're uncomfortable with the idea of NHS general practice. Actually, there's the money dynamic is something that is influencing you to go down the specialist route.
I think it is. Yeah, I definitely think it is. The other thing is in secondary care, I suppose you're really tailoring your skills rather than having to learn, you know, a broad range of skills.
You're getting much deeper level, more advanced skills in a particular area. Yeah. And I can see the appeal of that.
And, absolutely. You know, you can, by tailoring your skills and by working in a specialty, you kind of know what's going to come through the door. Is it, you know, Whereas in general practice, it's just, it's so broad.
Okay,
so,
I'm with you.
So broad.
I'm with you.
So literally anything can come through the door at any time. And you have to, you know, be prepared for that.
Yeah.
Whereas in, if, you know, even when I was working in the dental hospital, we'd have specialty clinics, and you can just kind of tailor your mind to that specialty.
Yeah.
So that makes it easy. So, you know, it just takes another stressful factor out of the equation.
Yes, I'm with you. Yeah. So you're more focused in terms of clinically.
Yeah.
You don't have quite the same patient expectation, so actually I can see the appeal. And would you say that's a view that's shared by some of your peers, most of your peers? Are they looking for careers in secondary care, or how?
Actually, on my scheme, my training scheme, I think some people may do a training year in hospital, but overall, most of them want to be associates.
Okay.
So that most of them actually want to stay in practice. So it's odd because I intercalated. So that's where you do another degree in between kind of third, fourth year of dental school. So I moved down a year. The old year that I was in, a lot of them were very interested in specialising. And then in the year I'm in now, it's just not really the case at all.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's quite bizarre. Yeah, very bizarre. I don't know why that is. I'm not sure why that is, but.
And are your current peers then thinking they would go down a fairly traditional career path of associate into practice ownership, or are they more interested in becoming associates or even working for a corporate?
So I think at this stage, most of them are just sticking to associates rather than, you know, jumping to practice ownership. A lot of them, I actually asked the people on my scheme, on my training scheme, and most of them said, you know, it would be lovely to own your own practice, but the question is, you know, could they cope with it? What does it entail? So because you at this stage, you don't really have that much insight into what needs to be done and the requirements and how much of your personal life you'd have to sacrifice to actually own a practice.
I think that's a really interesting point, because I think one of the things that's slightly worrying me is that there seem to be a lot of disincentives for people to think about practice ownership. And that point about intrusion on your personal life, I sense that's very important actually to current new generation of dentists who are really keen on getting that work-life balance right. And the perception seems to be that actually that's quite hard to do if you own a practice.
Yeah. So my worries. So I, in my, this is related, I promise, but in my kind of third intercalation year, fourth year, for 3 years, I actually set up an organisation at my university. It was dentistry related. But by setting something from the ground up, you gain a lot of insight into what it means to own, you know, to build something, and to basically run an organisation where money comes into it, basically, because that's what's going to keep your organisation or business afloat. And I think by doing that, it really, you know, and also by, you know, working where I am now, because my trainer is the practice owner. And he does an amazing job of it, but I just wouldn't even know where to begin. So my worries personally about, I'd love to own a practice, and I think, you know, you'd earn very well, and it would be very rewarding once it was up and running. But then when I honestly wouldn't know where to begin, because so much of it needs to be done at the same time. There's so much to think about, even, you know, outside the financial aspects of it. There's, you know, where do you get the kind of the loan from to buy the building, to buy the equipment? On average, how much money are you borrowing to do that? Where's the best place to get it from? You know, things like staffing. So yes, it's one thing, yeah, hiring, you know, qualified staff, but you know, sorting out payroll. There's so many things, logistical things to think about in owning practice that are just not clinic, you know, it's not clinically related, it is business related. And I think I set up an organisation in dental school on such a small scale, and I sacrificed so much of my personal life to make it work. Mm. So I don't know how people do it. it's amazing. I find all people who own practices, I think they're amazing people, mm-hmm. because so much dedication will go into it. And so it's a big gamble, isn't it? Because you're investing, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds in something that may or may not work.
Well, this is really interesting, and actually, if I'm honest with you, Jasmine, really encouraging, because it sounds like actually the desire to potentially own a practice is still there amongst you and your peers.
100%.
It's just that whereas, say, 20, 30 years ago, it was a relatively short step from being an associate to being a practice owner, because of the complexity of managing a practice with employment law, regulation, just how competitive that world is now, it's such a big step that actually you need a lot more support now than maybe people needed.
100%.
So that's encouraging for organisations like us, but also I guess current practice owners who might be thinking about succession planning, that actually they need to just think through how do they prepare an associate, arm them with the requisite skills, 100%. Not all in one go, but gradually. Yeah.
For the associate to take over. Yeah. So I think that's just building an associate up in the year and kind of building up their responsibilities and really showing them the ropes. So again, with the organisation that I ran in dental school, we had a crossover period, which usually lasted about 3 months, where we trained the new committee to take over. But, you know, even then, sometimes you only learn by doing. So you only learn once you fully take over a practice, or once you're on your own, really.
It feels like, I mean, I've come across a few practice owners that are actually gradually adding in certain business related responsibilities to what their associates are doing. So not, say, going from nothing to everything, but just saying, okay, you take responsibility for HR.
Yeah.
And then they learn and support them that way. And then once they've got that nailed, then they go on to something else. Is that the sort of thing that would help, do you think?
That would definitely help, yeah. I think categorising the kind of areas of owning a practice, so HR, the clinical side of things, the budgeting and financial side of things, that would 100%, you know, it would really break things down, and you'd be able to kind of really build on one area before moving on to the next, and then you'd be able to have an overall knowledge about things.
Okay, excellent. Well, I thought our time is up. Thank you very much indeed for being with us today, Jasmine. Fascinating talking to you.
It's okay.
And maybe we'll do this again at some point.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.